WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Joining me now on Fresh Air is Leonard Nimoy. I'm sure you know him as Spock in the TV series and film Star Trek. Recently, he's been taking his one-man show, Vincent, to theaters around the country. This is a show about painter Vincent van Gogh and his brother, Theo, an art dealer. Tonight, Vincent opens at the Walnut Street Theater for a run that continues through Sunday. The Walnut is on 9th and Walnut Streets, and the box office number for more information is 574-3550, and I'll be giving all that information again later. If you missed it. Leonard Nimoy, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Why a one-man show about Vincent van Gogh?
Script came to me in the mail about 3 years ago. I had heard about it. I wrote to the author. I was intrigued with the idea of the, particularly the fact that the central character that I'm playing would be Theo, his brother. And not being particularly interested in trying to do an imitation of Vincent van Gogh or an imitation of Kirk Douglas playing Vincent van Gogh, because Douglas did the movie Lust for Life a number of years ago, I thought that's a unique kind of posture from which to see this character. And I read it, read the play, was intrigued with it, moved by it. There was some interesting humor. Also coming out of the fact that Theo, who did have some flair for sarcasm, could be a little funny about his brother here and there, where perhaps if you were doing Vincent himself, I don't think Vincent could be humorous dealing with an audience. You know, he was a shy, introverted man who preferred to be only in the company of artists. And a powerful story to tell about devotion. Theo's devotion to Vincent, among other things, and Vincent's devotion to trying to be useful in the world. I think that if there were one way I could sum up Vincent's life, it was a desire to be useful, to serve some purpose, as he put it, and be of some good. I was very moved by it, and I thought, this is challenging enough, I'll get into this.
How do you deal with his madness?
Well, the madness in Vincent's case, of course, is the easy handle that most people attach, and that's the myth that's been handed down, or the notion that's been handed down. I suppose you could make a case for madness, but there's an even stronger case for epilepsy. He was diagnosed as being epileptic by two doctors of the period that we know of. The records are still available, and when he was admitted to the hospital at Arles after the ear-slashing incident, his episodes were described as epileptic in nature. And when he lived later on of his own volition, of his own choice, at the hospital at Saint-Remy, also in the south of France, the doctor there described his patterns as those of an epileptic. And Vincent described the hallucinations that he was having in great detail in letters to Theo, to his brother. He wrote, we have over 600 letters that still are available to us. And he described the symptoms as being audio and visual hallucinations, which are today recognized as probably being psychomotor epilepsy, an excessive electrical charge going to the frontal lobe of the brain, tripping him into these seizures.
That's interesting. You know, there's quite a myth and romance about madness and art. And for a lot of people, it is madness that qualifies you to be an artist, and it's insanity that brings you in touch with your deep creative impulses. How do you handle that in the show? Because there is such a romance surrounding insanity nowadays.
Yes, and Vincent perhaps is the archetype, the mad genius painter who gave his life and his brains for art. You know? What can I say? I do point out, as Theo, I'm trying to make the case that Vincent worked hard to accomplish what he did. The work was not the result of madness, and the madness didn't help one bit. He worked for years studying his draftsmanship and his craft and mastered his technique. And as a matter of fact, we have evidence to show that when he tried to paint during the course of any of these seizures, the work was totally unsuccessful. He couldn't. He was physically destroyed temporarily by these things and was flat on his back or in hot baths for weeks until he recovered his strength and his equilibrium. When he painted, in between the seizures, which he had fairly regularly, like every 3 or 4 months once they started, and he knew they were coming, he could almost anticipate them, he painted in frenzied, furious periods of work in order to get some work done because he knew there was another attack coming, which was totally aside and destructive to his work. And he wrote to Theo and said, I'm painting day and night because either the weather or my illness will stop me soon enough. So when people stand in front of a Van Gogh painting in a museum, which I've experienced a number of times, you'll be standing there and you'll hear people saying, oh boy, he just got crazier and crazier, and they claim they can see the madness in his work. It really is a romantic notion. It's just not true. The technique in his work is deliberate, logical, precise, and premeditated. It has nothing to do with his stability or his mental condition. Now, I'm not making a case for Vincent being the most stable, next-door guy kind of your local factory worker by any means. He was not. He was obsessive. He was a compulsive man. He was self-defeating, self-destructive, terrified as much by success as he was by failure. Had great difficulty carrying on lengthy relationships and had a terrible love life. Terrible. Just was always setting himself up for disaster. Evidently did not know how to relate to a woman except by romanticizing her, and in some cases that drove them away. He finally ended up having only relationships with prostitutes, and it seemed to be the only kind of periodic comfortable kind of relationship he could have. So with all of that, I'm not making a case that he was your average guy. But on the other hand, there was definitely a physical problem, and that physical problem and whatever he was mentally are not part of the work. If his work was affected by what we will call his lack of equilibrium, his lack of stability, it was only in the obsession and the motivation to work harder and to work himself harder. He was, I would say, quite masochistic in that sense. I must work harder. I must produce more. I must be better. I must be good. So in that sense, there was a great source of energy, motivation to get good work done. But the work itself, I don't think, is a reflection of his condition. I think it's a reflection of his mastery of a craft.
When you're portraying a real character, do you think that it's important to have a physical resemblance to the way he looked?
Well, I suppose if you're playing Mark Twain, people want you to look like the famous portraits that they've seen of Mark Twain, and Hal Holbrook did that quite successfully. And I suppose if you're playing Harry Truman and give him Hell Harry, they want to be able to see some kind of resemblance. They say, yeah, gee, he really looked like him, you know, and they walk out of the theater. I think that's an important part of it from an entertainment point of view. I've tried to avoid that again by playing Theo. I wouldn't want the evening to be summed up by, gee, he really looked like Vincent looked in his self-portraits. You know, I think that's a trick rather than what I'm trying to get to. What I'm trying to get, and if I walk out on stage and I say, I'm Theo Van Gogh, I want to talk to you about my brother, there is no visual barrier to be overcome. People aren't going to look around to each other and say, gee, he doesn't really look like. They don't know what Theo looks like. There's no comparison. It happens I do look much more like Theo than Vincent, and since I grew the mustache for the role, I feel like that comes off successfully. Now, in the show, we are using rear screen projections. We show about 150 of Vincent's works, including, I think, about maybe 6 or 8 or 10 of his self-portraits. So if I was standing on stage in a Vincent makeup while you're seeing the work on the screens, there would be this comparison problem. I think, therefore, that I am free in this particular production to create a character called Theo Van Gogh. I know as much as is available on Theo. I've read the letters that he wrote to Vincent and what I've gathered from writings of other people of the period who wrote about both brothers, and also from trying to understand who it is that Vincent was writing to when he wrote all those Dear Theo letters. I have a pretty good fix in my mind of what Theo was, but it's terribly important that I bring on stage a character that can make this evening function, make it come to life, so that you believe me as Theo, you believe that I was, that Vincent was my brother, Vincent just died a week ago, that Vincent was my brother, that I have certain things that I want to express about him. Some of them are flattering, some are not. But I'm trying to give people a picture of the human being that was my brother and what it was he was trying to do with his life. That's the most important thing.
One-man shows about figures who really lived have become very popular. I wonder why you think they have become as popular as they have, both among actors and audiences.
Well, for me, it's challenging. I don't know. I can't really say that I understand the audience interest. I suppose there's something unique in going to see a person do a performance, to sit and watch a performance, and hopefully that character comes to life for you. And I think, again, particularly for characters that people have heard about or seen in their lifetime or a part of their past, like Truman or Twain or whatever, that it's a kind of a reminiscence evening. Let's sit down with this person and spend a little time in his company. I think particularly that was true with Harry Truman, because many of us who've gone to see the production were around when he was president. So we have some sense of what it was like to be a citizen under his presidency. And here he is on the stage talking to us. So there's something about that works, I suppose. In my case, I'm not sure. I think ours is a little different in that we are doing a painter, a man known essentially for his visual work and not for his speeches or his acts during a political life or whatever. So it's a little different, and that's why we've incorporated the visual aspect. I think this is more of a multimedia show than what anything I'm aware of in a one-person show in the past.
When you do a television episode or a film, you do a few takes of it, and once it's shot, it's shot, and you don't have to perform that again. Mm-hmm. But the document lives on for many years, either in syndication or in movie archives,
so,
repertory
yeah.
theaters. But when you're doing a show, like Vincent, you've yeah. been touring then around the country, and
yes.
you perform it many times over, but in the end it remains pretty ephemeral because once the performance is over,
yes.
it's over. Do you have any preference for movie, television, or stage?
Well, if you're involved in a great piece of work, you'd like to have it immortalized on film and know that future generations will be able to see it and it becomes something a little bit more permanent that you can leave behind. I've had my share of that. I've been involved in projects which I'm sure people will be looking at for years to come. So it's not that I feel I'm missing that part of my life or career. On the other hand, I can vividly remember so many wonderful theatrical experiences that I had as an audience, seeing great performances or important performances on a stage as I was growing up. And for me, as an actor, the really intense experience of dealing with an audience and memorizing a role completely and playing it a number of times is a much more penetrating experience and stays with me a much longer time than a lot of the films or television jobs that I've done and forgotten about, really, really quite forgotten about. And I think possibly the same thing is true with an audience. I think an audience tends to forget more of the television dramas or whatever entertainment they've seen, and perhaps some of the movies, but probably remember quite well a lot of the theatrical experiences that have been special for them.
Star Trek is still on television, and there's a whole new generation of people growing up with it as if it was a first-run thing. I wonder, when you're growing up with television, if you know the difference between first-run and syndication and reruns. So I wonder how that's affecting your career and your image to have you from maybe 10 years ago always on the screen and
in people's minds. I find very few people who watch reruns like that who actually believe this is the first run. I think people are pretty well aware of the difference between shows that are being done now and shows that were done some time ago. I don't know how they pick up that information, but they seem to pick it up pretty fast. Maybe it's conversation in grade school. Well, those are reruns, you know. I don't know. But I don't have people approaching me and saying, "Are you still shooting Star Trek?" Or how many episodes are you going to make? Or will they really relate to my being in production in the television show now? I don't have that kind of experience. I suppose that they can tell the difference, that this is today and that was done then. And they're curious about the future of Star Trek. Will there be any more? Will there be a sequel to the movie and that kind of thing? But I do think they make the separation.
To what extent do you carry all the Star Trek experiences with you? Is it a thing of the past, or is that something that whose interest
part of my life? Always, people are always asking me about it, so it's constantly being brought back to a conscious level. I'm always aware that people are aware that that was my major kind of burst into public awareness, public recognition. And it's also a very important part of my life in terms of the work. I'm very proud of some of the work that I did on that series. Not all of it, but you can't expect that. It's miraculous that we could turn out 78 episodes as we did at the price we did and under the schedule that we did. And it was an intense experience for the 3 years. But I do remember some of the moments very pleasantly and very proudly, and some of the films very proudly. There are a few that if there were one on tonight, for example, of my favorites, I might sit and watch it. Some others, I'd watch the first 5 minutes and not want to be confronted with it. You know?
Well, what is it about some of those episodes that you don't like? Is it the story of it or the way
it
was shot?
Yeah, I thought, you know, every once in a while when you're dealing with... we were taking chances. It was an adventurous show. It wasn't a predictable show, I don't think, in terms of... it just simply wasn't predictable. When you're taking chances... you sometimes run into a trap or make a mistake, and maybe the first act sounds terrific in the telling, and then the writer sits down to write it, and he writes three acts, and the last two are just horrible. They just don't go anyplace. There's no place to go with the story. And you have to shoot it because you're under pressure and you don't have another script ready. And here's the crew waiting in the cast, and they're all on salary. Get out there and shoot this thing and maybe try to fix it as you go along as best you can. But we did a few that nobody was jumping up and down about.
And then you have a document of it. That
yes, that's right. It's around for a long time.
My guest is Leonard Nimoy, if you're just joining us, and he's in Philadelphia for his one-man show, Vincent, a show about painter Vincent van Gogh and his brother Theo, and that opens tonight at the Walnut Street Theater. When you're looking over a script for either a film or perhaps a television episode, what are you going to look for in the script to see if it's something you're interested in or not? How do you appraise these things?
Well, I tend to not be terribly interested in scripts that are simply adventurous and time-filling entertainment, even when they're quite good. Maybe that's a fault on my part. I guess I kind of grew up in a theatrical background that asked for more than that. I grew up playing Clifford Odette's very important social comment dramas, and I guess I still look for some comment, something that's topical or timely or universal about mankind, something that says something. And I look for an opportunity to make a statement, either positive or negative, towards the theme, either be involved in the thematic concept or be the antithesis of it or whatever, so that I can help make the statement, play a character in which I feel I can express some energies. A lot more than that enters into it. One wants to know who's going to direct this thing and how much time do we have to do it properly and where will it be done under whose auspices or what auspices. There are a lot of factors that go into making a comfortable situation for me, and the more I learn, the more kind of demanding I become. The more experiences I have, the less I take for granted. I really want to know who and where and what, and I probably become difficult as a result and maybe even make it difficult for myself because the demands become more and more specific.
It's interesting the way you stress a director. I know for myself, if I'm reading a screenplay the way it's been packaged into a book, which screenplays sometimes are, if I haven't seen the film, I really can't get a sense of how it's going to look as a movie. Of course, you never know unless you've seen the movie. But when you're reading the screenplay, the screenplay's probably going to be changed once you're acting anyway.
Well, screenplays, are particularly for a motion picture, are very vulnerable to all kinds of effect, whether it be budget, whether it be director, whether it be the producer, or a star who distorts or wants to change or has a different concept and comes in to go to work to change the concept of the piece to satisfy what the reason he took the role, because he sees in it something that's not necessarily in the script that he wants to head for during the shooting. Schedule, budget. In television, it's pretty much clear cut. You see what's on the script, and you pretty much know how they're going to do it. And any one of a dozen directors can shoot it; it'll look exactly the same. You don't get a personal imprint quite as much in television as you do in a motion picture.
You had an interesting role as a psychiatrist in The Invasion of the Body Snatchers, the film that was released last year, 1979.
That's a role that I would not have taken had I read the script.
How come?
Because the role that we ended up playing on film was not in the script. It simply wasn't there. The character was in the script, and there were suggestions of the scenes, but the scenes were not developed at all. And there was no sense of some of the great fun we had with that character in the script. It just wasn't there. It wasn't developed. I had a meeting with Phil Kaufman and the producer, Bob Solo. And I had heard of Phil's work and had seen some of his work, and I was impressed with his work, and I was impressed with him as a person. And I took the job really on faith because he described for me what he wanted to capture. And said at that time, the script is not ready, but we have to have a decision. We have to know who's going to play these roles, and you'll have to let us know, I'm sorry, without seeing the script. I think it was a ploy. I think the script was ready, but that they realized that people would not be excited about what they read on the printed page. Well, for me, it worked, and I'm glad it worked out that way. Excuse me. I got the script several days after I'd accepted the job. I was in Los Angeles, Phil was in San Francisco, and I called him at home on a Sunday. And I said, I really don't think I can make a contribution to this movie based on what's in the script. This is not what I had hoped for. He assured me that what he had in mind and what he had discussed with me was still his intention. And he had the talent and the sensitivity to pull it off. It was not on the printed page. We'd go to work every day and say, well, okay, the paper says so-and-so, the page says such-and-such about this scene. But what the scene really is about is this. How can we capture that? What could you say? What would you like to do? What would you like to wear? Who would you like to have in a scene with? You know, that kind of thing. Where would you like to sit in this room to try to give a sense that you are manipulating or being passive? You know, that kind of direction. And we used the script. The writer was there, D.W. Richter, who wrote the adaptation, was with us. And pretty much what was happening was that there was a lot of improvisation, which was quickly noted down on a piece of paper. And then Richter would take it to his typewriter and polish it a little bit here and there, a phrase or a turn of a word or whatever, bring it back to us. And that's how we played it. There was one scene that I played with Donald Sutherland that was never on paper until after it was filmed. He and I had a discussion with Phil about what was supposed to take place in that scene, brief little scene, conversational scene outside the balcony, outside his apartment, after we'd had this scene with all the other people inside, and he and I met outside as kind of a coda to this scene. And he and I both knew where our characters were in terms of position in the piece. And he said, well, we probably want to get into questions about each other and a little kind of feeling out about this or that. I said, right, and then ask a question about this or whatever. And we walked out there, and he said, why don't you roll the camera? And Phil did. And we just kind of chatted out there. And that was the scene. Now, we needed to get coverage, it's called, close-ups and over-the-shoulders and so forth, to repeat the scene. In order to repeat it, the script person then took and put headphones on her set and listened to the tape of what we had just done and wrote it out for us and handed it back to us so that we could then re-say, you need that for cutting purposes, re-say the scene several times. But that's the way the scene was originally played. First time that ever happened to me in motion picture work.
You didn't have a sense, having seen it back, that you wanted to do it over.
No.
That you would have said it.
No, we didn't see it back. We didn't see it back. We were on film. We wouldn't see that film until the next day or a couple of days later. I never saw it back. But I was quite satisfied, and so was Donald, and obviously so was Phil, that we had captured what the scene was supposed to be about.
When you play a role in a movie like Invasion of the Body Snatchers, I would imagine that you would come in to do your scenes and then leave again, and that you might not have a sense of everything that's happened around that role in the film. Is it hard to come into a film and then leave and not see it from beginning to end?
I try to avoid that. I try to be around as much as possible watching scenes that I'm not in, so I have some sense of the approach to the material, the style in which it's being played. And of course, there's a good chance that you can watch scenes in which there are actors who you will later do scenes with, but you're not in this particular scene that they're in. So you get to see how they're working, how their characters are evolving, and maybe get a better sense of how to play off those characters when your scenes with them come. So I try to be around as much as possible and see as much of the other work as I can.
What did you think of the final movie?
Body Snatchers, The Invasion of Body. I was very proud of it, very pleased with it. I think one of the critics, I've forgotten exactly, it might have been Judith Crist, said it may be the best film of its kind ever made. I'm inclined to agree. It went beyond the obvious. Phil has a way of getting inside a subject or inside a genre and coming right out the other side. He doesn't just get inside it and give you what you expect in that genre. He gives you something else. He gives you an additional turn on that genre. And I was very proud to be in it.
What are some of the roles or some of the types of films that you would most like to do?
Oh, I don't know. I'm very bad with that kind of question. I'm really at the mercy of the script that comes in the mail tomorrow. I don't have a kind of a grand plan of where I should be going with my career or what kind of roles I should be looking for. I'm very poor with that. And if I were to go back to the hotel this afternoon and find a package and open it, and there's a great script in there, it could be about I don't know what, and I might end up doing it if I really got excited reading it. I say, hey, I'd like to be in this, you know, even against the advice of people around me, agents, friends, relatives, whatever. I don't know. I'm really susceptible to an idea that's presented well and properly and timely.
Do people have a certain image of you in mind when they send you a script?
I think so. That can get to be a little bit of a problem. And for that reason, I do try to expand my own thinking about myself so that I don't fall into the pattern of their thinking about me. But it hasn't really been very much of a problem, particularly theatrically. I find that theatrically I'm quite welcome doing pretty much anything I want to try to do. Fail at it, fine. Succeed at it, fine. But try. But I think a lot of low-budget filmmakers perceive me as perhaps the way of getting their science fiction or horror fantasy film done, you see, and they'll send me these creaky little plotty little scripts, you know, which are sincere and honest efforts, but they're just not what I'm looking for at the moment.
How do you respond to something like that?
Well, in some cases, I'll say just exactly that. I'll say, look, I really don't want to be the king of the horrors, or whatever, creepy, squeaky, science fiction kind of things, you know. Thank you for thinking of me and find somebody else. I find my greatest range of opportunities has come theatrically. And I'll go any place to do an interesting. I went to Sullivan, Illinois. There is such a place about 100 miles south of Chicago, a tiny little town, because they offered me the opportunity to play McMurphy in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, a role that you wouldn't normally think of me doing. And it was a wonderful exercise for me. And I've done a lot of that kind of thing all around the country.
Your image has been in front of the American public for many years now. Everybody knows your face. Mm-hmm. Do you get stopped a lot in restaurants and on the street?
Find that since I grew the mustache, which has not had an awful lot of exposure yet, it has changed my appearance enough so that I have a little bit more privacy than I used to have on the street. There still is quite a bit of recognition. I do have a television series on the air called In Search Of, and last season I had this mustache on, so some people have seen that. It's a very popular series. I find in general that that people are, for the most part, sensitive about invading people's privacy. I think the funniest line that I'm often approached with, people don't realize what they're saying, it will be something like, I really hate to invade your privacy, but, you know, and then they will. And you're tempted to say, well, if you hate to, don't. You know? But they do occasionally, and they're kindly about it. I understand that's part of my business.
Does it bother you when you're stopped?
When I'm stopped?
Yeah.
Not as a rule. Not as a rule. I may be in some kind of a delicate situation where I'm rushed for time or something and people become overly demanding, and then it becomes irksome. But I do find that for the most part people are decent about it.
Do you think we in this country have unusual expectations of our celebrities?
I don't think we understand them. I don't think it's that we have. Yeah, maybe I think we're probably talking about the same thing. I think that the press creates unusual expectations of our celebrities, and therefore people don't think of celebrities in terms of working as working people. We are working people. We do a job. I see myself as a workman. I go to work tonight to entertain an audience, to move them, touch them, make them laugh. There are certain moments in that play where I want them to laugh. There are other moments when I hope there'll be tears. And that's a craft that I have worked at long and hard. And if I'm successful at it, fine. That's what I do for a living. Now, I think that there is a tendency amongst the press to glamorize and glorify and mythify and whatever, so that people don't quite understand what it is that we do, you see. Now, maybe that's the way it has to be. I'm not saying it should be different. I'm just saying that's the way it is in answer to your question about what we expect of our celebrities. And then again, even within that, I think there are different expectations. I think that that audiences will accept and go along with certain people doing bizarre things in their personal lives and go right on doing their movie or television careers or stage careers or whatever. In other cases, they want certain people to be quite different, to function differently. In other words, they have a kind of a scenario laid out in their minds about what kind of life that person should lead privately. And if that person steps over the boundaries of that kind of scenario, they get very upset with them. They say, you're not supposed to do that. Well, you know, that's not right. That's, you're not that kind of person or whatever.
Do you think there's a scenario that a lot of people have of the private life you're supposed to be
having? If there is, I don't want to know what it is. I don't know.
You ever at home and think about how many people are probably wondering what you're doing at that moment?
No, I've never had that experience, really. No, I have, for example, sat in theaters to watch a performance in a film in which I worked and wondered what would happen if people in the theater knew that I was in that theater.
Did you do that for Star Trek? Did you ever see it in a theater?
Yeah, I saw it once in a theater, but it was the premiere, the world premiere in Washington, and we were all announced as being there, so I didn't have an opportunity to sneak in and see it, and I haven't seen it since. But in other films in which I've worked, I've had that experience, and that's kind of strange, you know.
Is once enough to see a movie like the Star Trek movie for you?
I will have to see it again for a number of reasons. When you say is once enough, I'm not really sure what the question really means. To capture, you know, mean to understand it? Or see
for
it
you, you know, I don't know to that, see your I don't own performance and to get a sense of the whole movie, how it came together.
It was enough for me in terms of my performance because that's something that I was very specifically involved with and could relate to, and I knew what I was trying to do in each scene and did it work or didn't it or would I prefer to have done something differently. Yes, once was enough for that. I would like to see it again to evaluate my first thoughts and see if they still hold up. I don't know if I saw the film 20 times if I could ever be objective about the film, about the whole film. I don't know. I think it turned out to be the kind of film that for some people was more than satisfactory and for some people was less than satisfactory. A terribly subjective kind of response to that film, and mine is subjective too. So I don't know.
Yeah, you ever able to be objective about a movie that you're in?
Yes. I've seen some that
I've
said to myself, now I wish I hadn't done that movie. I mean, I had low expectations for it, and it did not rise above my expectations. On the other hand, I've been involved in projects that were pleasant surprises. So I thought, well, I don't know that this is really is what it should be. And then I see what happens on the screen and sense the audience reaction to it. And I say, hey, it works. It works. It does what it's supposed to do. It does more than I expected it to.
Well, Leonard Nimoy, it's been terrific to be able to speak with you. I wish you luck in your performances of Vincent here at the Walnut Street Theater
thank
in
you.
Philadelphia. And thanks so much for being here.
Pleasure. Thank you.
I've been speaking with Leonard Nimoy, who is in Philadelphia to perform Vincent, which is a one-man show about painter Vincent van Gogh and his brother Theo, who is an art dealer. You probably also know Leonard Nimoy from his movies and television appearances, including his role as Spock on Star Trek. Vincent opens tonight at the Walnut Street Theater. It continues with performances through Sunday. The Walnut is on 9th and Walnut Street. If you'd like any information about the performances, I'll give you the box office number. You'd be calling 574-3550. Again, that's 574-3550. Thanks again for being here.
Thank you.